Hello there. Welcome to episode 4 of Bow and Blade, a podcast brought to you by Medievalist.net, where all things medieval come alive. Bow and Blade gives you a seat at the bar as scholars of medieval warfare go beyond the Wikipedia articles to talk about the debates and questions that we're working on today. I'm Michael Livingston, professor at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina.
And I'm Kelly DeVries, professor at Loyola University in Maryland.
So what are you drinking tonight at the bar here, Kelly?
Well, I was thinking about some Rhodian wine, but the grapes on Rhodes aren't really the best. Not like Cretan wine or Cypriot wine. So maybe I'll just drink a deep red wine. The color will become obvious, I think, in our discussion. A deep red wine from some Eastern Mediterranean island.
That's very good. That's very good. And we should probably point out for the listeners at home, when he's talking about a Cretan wine, he's speaking about wine from Crete, not being derogatory towards the wine.
No. Cretan wine is wonderful.
Yeah. I probably ought to be drinking some Summa, but the bar is fresh out here. Summa would be definitely the thing to do in Rhodes. So I'm sipping on a bit of ouzo. Seemed appropriate. Seemed like the thing to do, given our Greek topic. Yeah.
Not Retsina.
No.
But you like Retsina so much.
I don't. This will come up. We're not going to give it away now. This will come up. There was
a bit
of an evening at one point. But at any rate, before we get to today's topic, our dear listeners, we want to hear from you. We really do. And we would encourage you to drop us a line through our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/medievalists, so that you can let us know what questions you have about medieval warfare. Like, do you want to know if a longbow can really punch through plate like it does in the movies? Do you want to know just what the heck a Shiltron was anyway? Whatever it is. What else might they want to know, Kelly?
What happens and, what about leadership? Mm-hmm. What do we call a general on the battlefield? You know, because last week with Joan of Arc, I mean, was she a general? Was she the general? That's an interesting question.
Good.
It could be mercenaries. Why, when did they fight? Why did they fight?
It could be something specific.
And anything about, various armies, various battles, various wars.
If you want our specific opinion on some controversy in medieval warfare, let us know, because next week our plan is to do our darndest to answer the questions that you provide on the Patreon page in our first ever Bow and Blade Q&A. We hope to make this a regular occurrence. If you all give us the stuff, we'll do it. God help us if we get it right or not. We'll find out.
I'm sure we'll find out immediately.
Comments. I'm sure we will. So please do send us your questions on the Patreon page again, patreon.com/medievalist, and we'll see you there. So all that aside, tonight's topic is the first siege of Rhodes in 1480.
Yeah, we're getting away from England and France and from the conflicts the two of them had. I mean, we'll return. There are too many English and French conflicts to get to leave them completely. But we wanted to get somewhere different geographically, Eastern Mediterranean, and we wanted to get to some armies that were deep enemies. I mean, this is a religious war we're talking about. Some might even say it's an extension of the Crusades. But we're talking about the Ottoman Turks, and we'll, talk about their rise, talk about what they're doing by this time, 1480, and their expansionist wishes into the Eastern Mediterranean, specifically against Rhodes. Now, who's defending Rhodes? Oh, those are medieval monastic warriors. So, yeah. Mike, you teach cadets. They want to be leaders. They want to be elite soldiers and so forth. When you tell them that there were a certain number of groups of medieval monastic warriors, what do they think?
So obviously, some of them are familiar with these folks, but most aren't. And we get some pretty wild imaginings of this. Some people almost have this impression of like the knight from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the old kind of crusader guy, right? That sort of idea. These are just, they're just crusaders walking around.
Choose wisely.
And which actually isn't that horrible a picture, really, as we'll talk about. But on the other hand, I also get some people who they hear that word monk, and they kind of go into monk like somebody's not really using armor. They might even be using some martial arts moves here or something. And which is not accurate.
No, it could have been in my youth. I mean, we had Kung Fu on TV with David Carradine, the most oriental actor they could find, no doubt, playing a Shaolin monk. So there was a notion of Eastern Asia, Asian monks who were also martial artists. These are not.
Yeah.
They're martial artists, but they don't use Bruce Lee moves at all. But I'm also glad that we're actually not a few years back when everybody was reading Dan Brown, because it's come out and we got great TV like Templars in America.
Yeah. And we should say here, we're going to be doing Knights Hospitaller, not Knights Templar. Templars are overdone. Hashtag overrated. Yeah. We're doing Hospitallers here. I'm going to get all kinds of hate mail for that, for saying.
I don't know. I mean, we could take them to our favorite restaurant in Paris, where you can look out of where the Templars are burnt while you eat steak.
It's such a great place.
Great place. Hospitallers don't get burned or heresy. I think there's probably times that they get called heretics, but they're not. They're pretty straight-laced when it comes to that. They may even have been the first founded, although it seems that the Templars and the Knights Hospitallers, the Knights of the Temple, the Knights of the Hospital, were founded around the same time, second decade, the 12th century in Jerusalem. They founded for a very good reason. Everybody's leaving. They don't have any troops. I figure the first crusaders make it all the way to Jerusalem. They start out perhaps with 100,000. They get there with maybe 20,000. That probably is an exaggeration. And then there's a lot of them that say, yeah, by the way, we're done. See you later. We're going back home. And they didn't have a lot. You figure that much difficulty. They got to have some replacements. Reinforcements are trickling in for Europe. So here, let's make you a warrior, but also serve the church.
I got to ask this question because I know people are going to wonder this. This is Knights Hospital are officially the Order of Knights of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem. What are we talking about when we talk about a hospital?
Well, we're probably using the word that really comes down to us in English. The Latin word that comes down to us in English is hospice and hostel and hospital. So it appears that the Knights Hospitaller begin as an order that is founded to assist crusaders that are wounded and ever aging crusaders. I mean, some of these guys have lived around 1120s, 1130s, but they've had a large, hard trek all the way over there. And some of them need care and getting older and so forth. So the Knights Hospital is founded to take care of these guys. That's the hospital part. And they, by the way, they keep that all the way through. And there's two hospitals in Rhodes still from the time the hospitals were there. And they're massive. So they still kept that. There's also the idea that they would be hostels where people could stay and especially individuals coming out of Europe that weren't, going to be, there's no apartments available or whatever, have a bed at the
hospital. for the pilgrims coming, to Jerusalem, a safe place to stay, keeping protection for those folks. So this is a really important gig that they've got. Really important gig.
We don't even know when they change, because they appear to be they don't appear to be bellicose originally. So they develop into this warrior monk sometime in that period, and we're not entirely certain why or for what reason.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah. So it's probably, yeah, going back to the 12th century there. All right. So this group, we're not going to be talking about anything they're doing in Jerusalem. We're going to Rhodes, the island of Rhodes. No. And I think if we got to start anywhere with this, we need to probably start with Rhodes. Like, why Rhodes? Why is this place so important? And for the listeners at home, you can look at a map. This is a decent sized island right off the coast of Turkey today, like right off the coast of Turkey.
Yeah. In fact, you see the mountains of Anatolia while you walk the walls, as long as the sun isn't shining and glaring off the sea.
Rhodes is an absolutely incredible place. We will probably go off on several tangents just talking about how much we love going to Rhodes. Kelly knows Rhodes backwards and forwards. It's really amazing. It is one of the coolest places to go visit. Yeah. So,
and that's why everybody wanted it.
Well,
it's there because of the strategic value, the trade value. I mean, it's important in the ancient world. And basically the Hospitallers and the Templars fighting in 1291 at the last bastion of the Crusades, they lose at Acre and they have to go somewhere, and they all go to Cyprus, and then the Templars leave. They go off on other ventures. But around 1306, the Hospitallers decide to move from Cyprus to Rhodes. Now, there was one problem. Rhodians don't want them there. Not necessarily. Rhodes is part of the Byzantine Empire. They're actually Greek Christians. They don't really want a lot of Latin Christians coming in and taking them over. But the Hospitallers
do. But they do it anyway. they do it anyway.
These guys are warriors, and so there's not a lot that there's not a lot the Byzantines are going to do because they're starting to fight the Ottomans, but the Rhodians can't do anything.
And Rhodes, it really does have a kind of central strategic location here for protecting maritime trade routes, the movement of forces in around this area. And obviously symbolically, there is that too, that it is this, it's so close to Turkey. Mm-hmm. That's not going to necessarily sit well with the other side. And in particular, it ultimately draws the ire of a certain special someone who is in charge of the Ottomans. Who's that fella, Kelly?
The great Sultan. Mehmed II. Our boy who conquers Constantinople turns his eye towards Rhodes. In fact, there's two things that are keeping his expansion from being pretty much centrally located in the middle of the Mediterranean. And one of those is Belgrade. It's still hanging on. And he goes there in 1456 and loses. The conqueror is conquered at Belgrade. And then he turns his eyes in 1480, not personally, he's ailing and will die in the next year in Istanbul, Constantinople. But he turns his eyes towards Rhodes because Crete and Cyprus, those are held by the Venetians. They've got trade agreements and they've got non-aggression pacts and all sorts of things. The Venetians basically are given anything to the Ottomans they can to hold on. You know, funny thing is, 1306, I don't think that the Hospitallers anticipated this. I mean, the Ottomans are just beginning at that point. And so I don't know, the Hospitallers really were looking at this as the last bastion of Christianity, as it's sometimes called later on. But it becomes that.
Yeah.
All the period of time they're there.
Yeah, it escalates quickly.
It
escalates really quickly.
And part of it's their doing, because you listed all those good things about Rhodes. The Hospitallers, to be fair, would call themselves Piratus, because they did pirate Muslim ships.
Yeah. Anybody who's trying to move through this passage, they figured they had rights to.
they did. And of course, justification. We forget that. I mean, this is a crusade to justified wars.
So you can see why, you know, why Mehmed would want this symbolically, you know, financially. There's lots of reasons he wants them out of Rhodes.
He really wants them out of Rhodes. So I mean, you've got a medieval monastic order on an island 26 kilometers off your coastline. It's pretty. I mean, I think we could probably read Mehmed's thoughts on this.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a lot of
and an order that's like predatory on your own ships the whole time. So
on your own ships, yeah. So he's got justice too, and he's also got the religious ideas. I mean, he will call some of these excursions, some of these attempts, the sieges of Constantinople, for sure, as jihad. That is his perception of jihad. So this is a religious war, as well as a war for other reasons, economic, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean.
And you know, the Hospitallers, they kind of know this is ultimately going to come. I mean, you know, that at, not at first, but by the time Mehmed's kicking around, they kind of know something's in the wind. It's not a huge shock.
But if in the middle of the 15th century, in fact, middle of the 15th century, they decide, geez, we better build fortifications around here. The Byzantine walls, which you can still see part of in Rhodes today, in a tower or two, they didn't encompass the whole of the city. They only encompassed part of the knights that settled in, and they weren't strong. So in the middle of the 15th century, they go on a huge wall-building experience. And they dig the moat out around the wall, about 20 meters or so, a moat. And they keep those walls up. The Grand Master at the time in 1480, his name is Pierre d'Aubusson. And almost the day he gets there, he becomes Grand Master in 1476. And by the time he gets there in the middle of June, he almost immediately starts. We got letters from him, and he's writing to everybody, and everybody he knows, please send money, send men, send architects, send diggers, you know, because, and it always finishes everything, because the Turks are going to attack.
Yeah. And Pierre d'Aubusson, you're going to hear his name quite a bit. This guy is a legend. The guy's a machine. He's fascinating, really fascinating. And we've got great information about him, not only from his own letters, but from things were written about him by a guy named Cowerson. We'll hear about that in a minute, because it really is pretty cool stuff. So this is the siege. I ought to point out, we're talking about in 1480. Now there's going to be another siege of Rhodes in the next century. That's a different one. And if you go to Rhodes today,
1522, coming up to this 500 year.
If you go to Rhodes today, you're going to see these amazing fortifications. They're absolutely incredible. But of course, what you're seeing is mostly from the 1522 siege. There's bits that go back, but you're seeing the buildup that has happened in the meantime, which we'll talk about in a later episode, because that siege is really incredible. But even if you just go and look on Google Earth or something like that, and look at the fortifications, even though those are the 1522 fortifications that you're seeing on satellite, they map pretty well to 1480, and are a pretty good indication of this buildup that Kelly's talking about, because it is an enormous amount of buildup. They are ready for this when it happens.
And the medieval walls can still be seen. I mean, all these additions were done to the walls and around the walls, but medieval walls can be seen. And it's the easiest place to date, because the Grand Masters, about every 18 feet, would stick their coat of arms. And d'Aubusson's, for example, has the Hospitaller cross, which is a straight, unconventional cross, with his own personal cross. That came from the family d'Aubusson. And these changed. So you can go even back to the mid-15th century, see a couple of earlier grandmasters and what they had built, and then you can see what d'Aubusson builds. And then you can actually see what d'Aubusson builds after this siege. Oops, did I let it out?
Well, we're after the siege, so that's all right.
Yeah, I guess. The hospitalers win.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
So we're building up. We're getting ready. On the 23rd of May.
Because the Turks will attack.
And they do. On the 23rd of May, 1480, 160 ships, we're told, appear off the coast of Rhodes, bringing the Ottomans. The first of the ships bringing the Ottomans, we should say.
The first of the ships,
And this is a big fleet, because these are big ships. And do they make an easy landing?
Well, it looks like they make an easy landing because they don't land near the city of Rhodes. They land down the coastline. It is interesting. We know the numbers of ships. We know that they keep going back and forth. It's like a ferry service over to Turkey and back. And the harbor of Rhodes is blocked by a big chain. So there's probably two of them. They're chains. There's the military harbor and the merchants harbor. These harbors go all the way back into classical Greek times. But now they have towers on them, and the hospitals are built towers on. And there's big chains, like at Constantinople, big chains. And they do effectively block any traffic coming in, but also keep everybody inside. You can't actually go out either. So whoever's in the harbor or roads when on this May stays there.
You're in the safe room. you're gonna stay in the safe room. If you look at the satellite imagery again, the harbors that Kelly's referring to are the two on the left. There's actually three harbors that you see today, and we're talking about kind of like the two on the left.
Well, the third one, that's Diamond built later, and it has the big ships on it.
That's not there.
But we're talking about pretty big ships. The harbor is amazing to see how large it is. Yeah,
these two, and the military one is the one on the left, and that one's going to come up big time in this.
Big time. Because
that is what is separating the Hospitallers from the Ottomans, is that water, that body of water. So
the Hospitallers arrive in May, but they actually
not the Hospitallers, but the Ottomans.
Oh, the Hospitallers.
Hospitallers are always the there. Ottomans,
man. Oh my god! Yeah, sorry about that. Jeez, I maybe should drink a little less of this deep red wine.
Cheers.
I almost said it again. The Ottomans arrive in May, but they don't actually wage this siege for about 3 weeks. They're setting up. And one of the things they set up, and it's probably, it might surprise some, but not those who study the end of the Middle Ages, because we know this is an age where guns are available and they are big, especially Mechmeds. They, by the way, they're still around. Five or six of them are still around. And they are behemoths of gun technology, wrought iron. And three of them are set up at the church, which gets captured right directly across the harbor from the from one of the castles protecting the merchant harbor, and then also they can hit the Grand Master's palace, which is behind the walls but can be hit by these big bombards. We know that.
And there is a if you go to Wikipedia, you can actually see an image of the siege that was done, that shows these cannons that Kelly's talking about set up to be fired kind of over the water and into the Hospitaller area. And you'll actually see in the foreground this tower that sits at the end of what's called a mole between these between the two harbors, between the military and the commercial harbor. That's the Tower of St. Nicholas, and that's the coolest thing that happens in this entire siege involves that tower.
Well, we'll get there. Yeah. The Tower of St. Nicholas, and you can see it. I mean, it's still there today. You can actually see the part that they built on it. You can go up and you can see the parts that were destroyed in the 1480 siege and then rebuilt for 1522. This is often said to be where the Colossus of Rhodes stood. The worst of the seven.
It wasn't there.
Wonders, because it fell like in a few years. It wasn't there. It was probably up on the hill a bit more. And it certainly didn't stride over the harbor as the wonderful 1950s movie that shows these ships going under. You get there and you go, oh my heavens, that's a huge statue. No wonder it fell. Well,
it wasn't there. Sorry to disappoint everybody. But no.
Yeah.
So they start, the Ottomans set up this camp. They set up the camp, on the sort of north end of the island. And it is a massive encampment set up for the long haul. As Kelly's pointing out here, they've got these massive bombards. How big are these bombards? What kind of bore do they have?
Well, the bores are a meter, wide. They fire stone balls. They don't fire metal balls. I mean, geez, those would be so heavy you couldn't get in. As it is, they load these things with cranes to pick the ball up because the balls weigh 300-400 pounds. And it's interesting because they still litter the area around Rhodes. You can go see them. And some of them are granite, some of them are sandstone, and some of them are limestone. And I think there's probably a separate purpose for each one of these because the density would have been different. But nobody's really looked at it. Nobody tells us in the sources that they were different. But these are massive things. Nobody could take them home as a treasure right now. They just sit out there. So they figure they just lie around.
And you walk around and you see all these things everywhere, and you think that's just an interesting, thing that they have like as a motif as a community. That then they're like, those are these massive things that are shot.
Yeah, massive roads balls. Oh, geez. And we're told by Guillaume Carrison, who writes the official account. I mean, we've got a couple of unofficial accounts of written within the city. But Guillaume Carrison is the secretarius of the hospital order, is asked by or his commander. I don't know whether he writes at the direction of Pierre d'Aubusson, the history of the siege. And so he tells us that the first ones, that the siege opens with the firing of those three bombards. And that's how they know that the Turks are starting.
Yeah. And it's an eyewitness account. It's a fantastic account. Kelly's gone through this thing with a fine tooth comb, and what you've found is it matches, like you can't find many errors in this thing, can you?
No, I can't. And now Carrison is also interesting because he's writing in Latin. Mm-hmm. We know they're speaking all diverse languages in the hospital because they actually set the houses up based on what tongue is spoken. And they're still called the tongues today. And so the Germanic peoples would be up one, and then you'd have there's like three Spanish ones, because of course none of the Spanish can understand each other. So the Aragonese, the Castilian, and the Navarrese. But d'Aubusson speaks French. They all speak Latin. That's probably how it works out. But d'Aubusson is primarily French, and Carrison too. But Carrison's educated and he writes in Latin. And it's funny because a lot of these terms, especially the technology terms, if you think for guns or for ships or whatever, he gives the Latin term, and then he says, or a French term, and then he says, that will say in Latin. And then he describes it in Latin. And it's kind of fun, but it does tell us then what the technological terms are being used.
And this account that he's giving is so accurate, not just the technology, but near as we can tell, accurate to what is happening on the ground, because it maps so well, even to the point of distances and locations, because we can, like, we have all that still, so we can actually see and be like, wow, he's right, that would have happened exactly here, and that sort of thing, which is,
there's also illumination. So we have one manuscript of Carrison. It's an argument whether it's his or whether it's a copy. It's in Paris, and it has illuminations on it, and they're very accurate to the geography and the walls of Rhodes at the time of 1480 siege. There's also a contemporary painting done that is very accurate to it, so we can see what they looked like, and then you can match them to the walls that are still there, and recognize, and also some of the places that were attacked in 1480. because the changes are made literally on the Tower of St. Nicholas. Changes are just added to it.
And we don't have this for every siege. I mean, it's really cool to be able to see all this literally on the ground. We don't always get to do that. Yeah. So it's very cool. Yeah. So
plus sitting on the balls that we're using to attack while we're thinking.
Yeah. Let's just sit here for a minute, Kelly, and like, you know, just chill out. And,
Oh, we'll have an ice cream.
Yeah.
That was always, a picture of me holding an ice cream sitting on a gun shot outside the walls of Rome.
We have a rough life, man. We had a rough life. Mm. So on the 9th of June, the artillery starts up. The guns are firing. The bombards are going off. What do you think the feeling like is in Rhodes?
Well, they have to know gunpowder weapons. They probably have some there. In fact, we know that they have some there because some of the guns are preserved, and at least one dates before 1480. So it probably is there. They're a little bit different calibers, I think, the smaller guns used on the walls against the Ottomans. And Cowerson tells us that they do this as well. There's also some handheld gunpowder weapons on both sides. It's interesting because we actually could tell the distance they fire. Those on the side, the three bombards that are located on the other side of the Manjiki Harbor, the military harbor, that fire at the Tower of St. Nicholas, only hit half the Tower of St. Nicholas. In fact, Cowerson tells us at one point, and a couple other sources as well, that half the tower can't be brought down. And if you go today, you can see the line where that tower was brought down on the one side. The knights realized that they couldn't fire the bombardment, and they would actually go up and taunt the Ottomans from the top levels. In fact, there's one story that they had dinner there, and the Ottomans would have been able to see it. It's 240 meters.
So there. I mean, obviously, there's some shock and awe from these things going off, but also a pretty decent resiliency on the part of the Hospitallers that they're like, well, okay, we figured out what you can do with that, and we can cope with that, and we can stand here in this half tower and wave at you, and no doubt say a few things across the water. Maybe make a few gestures.
And the Ottomans must have thought that they were going to surrender or so. I mean, although they didn't in Belgrade of 1456, of course, they didn't in Constantinople in 1453. But they bring a lot of firepower. They bring a lot of men. They have Janissary choirs out there singing. And if you've ever heard of Janissary choir sing, then use it for Halloween because it'll scare any kid off your stoop. And big drums hung off camels and everything else. They're really making a lot of racket night and day as they begin the siege. So, the Hospitallers are prepared for this. This is what they want to do. This is what they, a monastic monk, military monk is only a monk if there's nothing, no one to fight.
And it's probably a really good time to talk about one of the many things that's remarkable about this, which is numbers. So the number of Knights Hospitaller here is 500.
Yeah. I mean, it's estimated, about 2,500. So we do have to mention that not all Hospitallers are Knights, only the ones of upper class. Dobuson is a noble. They get to be knights, and the others are sergeants or regular troops. So, you and me, I mean, I'd be like the lowest on the low, but, you could join the Hospitallers, be trained to fight and fight, but I wouldn't ever be able to be a knight, and so our numbers, but we're talking probably about 3,000 total Hospitallers, if that. And then there are some militia in Rhodes, but not many because the Hospitallers have not ever been completely secure with the Greeks. And in fact, they wall off their quarter in Rhodes. You can still see it today. They walled off their quarter from the rest of the town. So they may have had a few more. And certainly by the time the siege comes around, we do read Cowsill tells us that the townspeople are helping, but they're mostly helping delivering food, delivering ammunition, and delivering water.
So 500 technical knights hospitaller, and then a couple thousand hospitallers, you know, soldiers, and then the townsfolk trying to help out versus on the other side. Now this is a big question. Kelly and I have had many debates about this kind of thing. What do our sources say, Kelly, about the numbers of audience?
Well, I mean, Cowerson tells us, he only tells us the ships. I don't think he actually tells us numbers. There are a couple, and Daubuisson himself will write an account of the siege later on. And he puts the numbers as, you know, as 70,000 or so. The thing is, it really didn't matter. The Ottomans don't matter because they've got the entire of Anatolia 26 kilometers away. It's a ferry ride for most of them. And so however many soldiers they need, they can get.
But 70,000, do you believe?
Yeah. Probably not at the beginning. I mean, how many can 160 ships hold?
Yeah, I don't believe it. I don't believe it for a minute.
And deliver over 3 weeks. There's no doubt, because the Ottoman armies are big, and they're huge at Constantinople, and they're very big at Belgrade, that we're dealing with many, many thousand. I mean, against three.
Yeah, that's the thing, is even if this is off by, you know, even a factor of 10, right, you're still double the amount of people.
Yeah, double, triple, quadruple. It does. And they never, you know, you kill 100 of them, they get 200.
Right, right. I mean, this is a bit like, you know, fighting Hydra here, that you know, they keep multiplying. You know, the knights, you know, in the hospitals, they lose people. There's not a lot of opportunity to get more people in.
We do know that some get smuggled in. With, you know, you never get told exactly how they're doing this, because you can't actually get to the city. They've got Ottomans out there, plus the chains across the harbor. So we do learn that there are some smuggled in, but we're talking about maybe 10.
Somebody bringing in a message. Somebody taking stuff out. You know, it's not like
the mailman.
You know, this isn't the elves showing up at Helm's Deep here. Look at me, Lord of the Rings reference.
So every hospitaller who dies or is maimed or is taken out of service, he's gone. Yeah. There's not a replacement.
And your fighting capacity goes down by that much, right? And the attrition of this, not to mention the worry over sickness, when you're locked in as these folks were, this is tremendously difficult and trying times for these for these hospitallers. And it is a long siege, long siege.
They do have fresh water. There's a couple of wells that are very, you can even see them today in the city of Rhodes. And of course, because it was a previous Greek city, it has a lot of water. Foodstuffs, they've been storing it up. In fact, Cowerson tells us that they get all the everything off the countryside. The rest of the island is brought in. And at the very end, even roots and sprouts that had not yet been fully formed is brought in. We don't hear of starvation ever among the hospitallers.
And this, of course, is a brilliant move on the part of the hospitallers. This gives them foodstuffs and takes them away from the Ottomans. It's almost like a scorched earth kind of policy here.
Of course, the Ottomans could get
they can get whatever they want anyway, but.
Make
it difficult, cheap, you know.
They're having roast beef every night, and the hospitallers are eating sprouts and twigs.
All right, I got to get to the coolest to me, the coolest damn thing of this entire thing to me.
Just set it up. One quick sentence: Ottomans don't break the walls down. They don't get in. Did we say something wrong? Isn't this the military revolution? Aren't these medieval walls just supposed to fall? They don't. And it doesn't. It doesn't. No.
We'll gunpowder doesn't do the job here, is what Kelly's saying. Yeah. So they've got to figure out some other way than just trying to pound their way in. They're going to try something else.
All right. You tell a story. I'm actually looking at the illumination that's showing it right now, but you're better at telling.
Oh, the illumination's fantastic. It's a crazy. You know who should tell this story? Pierre Daubuisson should tell this story.
And
as it happens, folks, Pierre Daubuisson did tell this story. And he told this story in a letter, which you can find in translation in Kelly and I's award-winning Medieval Warfare, A Reader. So I'm just going to read just a bit of this, just a small bit of this, because it's just too much bloody fun. What they did here. So the Turks facing this problem, we can't just batter down the walls. That's not working. Let's come up with another brilliant idea. And what they did is they built special war galleys, completely armed and ingeniously outfitted for battle. These are Daubuisson's words. And there were also added certain heavy vessels on which there were bombards and stones that they might be set up on the tower and mole. This is the St. Nicholas Tower. So they're going to be able to, let's get these things on there. Let's take that tower and then we'll be able to like fire right into the city. Let's go right up the mole. It's going to be great. This is going to be great. Such a good plan they've got. Such a good plan.
Except the mole is kind of far from them. 240 meters. Still.
But this is a good plan. This is a good plan. And what they do is they build a bridge, essentially, out of boats. These small flat-bottom boats, and they tie these together. And Daubuisson talks about this. He describes this, and put these together and swing them like a huge gate, right? They sort of build this thing against the shoreline, kind of around the corner, as it were, so that. Yeah, the Hospitallers couldn't see what was going on. You can see how this would work. If you look at the map, you can see how they'd work on this thing. So they're able to bring this thing around and swing it into place.
Yeah, they anchor it onto their side, just over by where the bombards are.
Swing it across the mouth of the harbor so that the other side lands. They measured it out. They're good with the math.
Yeah.
Right at St. Nicholas Tower. And then they drop. They have ropes tied to this, little anchors tied to this with stones that they then drop into the water to anchor this whole bridge, this makeshift bridge of boats. And Daubuisson doesn't talk about this. Cowerson does. Talks about these guys running out there to throw the stones that are tied to these ropes. Like they're balancing on this bridge because it's unsteady at first until the anchors go down. And they're kind of running out there, pitching these little anchors over the side until the whole thing is ka-chunk in place
resting against the tower, against the mole where the St. Nicholas Tower
is.
And
you now have a bridge across this harbor. And what's the Hospitallers see this, right? You can't miss this.
Yeah, they're probably looking. I envision that they're looking out of the half of the St. Nicholas Tower that's blown up.
What the heck?
They can see it. And this has got to be amazing as this wooden bridge gets swung into place, pre-made, pre-assembled.
Absolutely brilliant.
Now, we have to say that the Beckman is not
here.
No,
he's not here.
He is back in Istanbul. So this is all done. I mean, you may know about it, but it's done by his general at the time, which is Misha Pasha is his name. But actually, he is a nephew of the last emperor. He's Palaiologos. Yeah. He is a Greek who is leading the Islamic armies against the Ottoman armies against the Hospitallers. And maybe it's his idea. We're not told because, of course, we're getting it from Cowerson and from.
I love telling this story to my students because, I mean, you know, not only is it incredible that they came up with this idea, like what a brilliant idea, put together the ideas of how to execute this, made it happen. And then we're prepared so that as soon as this thing gets locked into place, Ottomans come just screaming across this thing to knock him out.
Does Daubuisson give the number across? I think that we were talking about three and four across. So this isn't just a little footbridge. This is a pretty massive thing. I don't know that Daubuisson mentions it. Now, we should say Daubuisson has been very active in this siege, but of course they're not attacking the Ottoman. But what he has done is ride in his white robes and armor on the back of his white horse back and forth between the town and the mole and the and St. Nicholas Tower, so that they in a taunting of the Ottomans, yeah, so that they can't touch him. And he appears to go out as soon as, I mean, all the hospitallers must have, as soon as they realized what was happening, tried to reinforce those, the garrison that is in St. Michael's, or St.
Yeah, I mean, Dobasson says, he says when it comes, you know, they approach with utmost silence, but our ears were open and we were not asleep. And when they were discovered, they go running out there, girding their swords. I mean, so like they're still arming themselves on the run in order to get and try and sort of, you know, plug this bridge that's been made, you know, and get some men there.
Yeah.
And as Kelly said, it's only, you know, we're talking 4 men abreast. So this is a kind of a good move in the on the part of the hospitallers. If they can just stop it there, they can prevent this onrush with only a few men, as long as they can sort of, you know, keep up that defense.
And they do. Very few Ottomans actually make it off the bridge onto the mole. And those that do are immediately killed. I mean, we're told, I love the illumination has like bodies floating all around. Not a lot of hospitallers lose their lives. They're pretty well protected too. The Ottomans are a little, these are not, you know, your elite armies. We got Janissaries there. We're told that they're involved in all sorts of things that don't appear to have the elite warrior status that they will later get. But, you know, so these are regular soldiers. They're going across and meeting the knights and the soldiers of the hospitallers. I mean, these are guys who want to defend Christianity, and they are getting the chance to, and they do not let it go.
Yeah, and they're tanks. I mean, if they've got all their gear on, these guys are tanks, and they're probably kind of rolling in and out, you know, sort of like shifting in and out of the front line to keep up against this onslaught.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't matter how fit you are, you can't stay in front of this for that long. You're going to get really tired. Swinging a sword is hard stuff.
That's the only weak point of this whole plan, because you got to, you know, you're absolutely right. What a brilliant, brilliant tactic to swing a bridge over and so you can cross the water and not have to go underneath the walls and face the knights' fire. You know, they cross this bridge, but they can't get a large number across. What they need to do is have such surprise that they can get a good group over and then they can spread out, and then the hospitallers have to fight them. Because the hospitallers are seeing this, they only need, like you said, only need a very small front to attack, because the Ottomans can't go anywhere. And they're not backing up because there's still those coming.
Yeah, they're pushing forward.
I think they talk about the bridge being completely covered by Ottomans.
And it is all they need is that beachhead. But these first guys who get down there, these first hospitallers get down there on red alert and are able to hold it until the next guys get there, who hold it to the next guy, until pretty soon you've got it pretty much stopped up, which is outstanding. But of course, like, what are you going to do now? Like, what's the move now?
Yeah. I mean, the Ottomans can't do anything. They've got to just push forward and hope that they can move around the dead. And we're told this is, because we often talk about medieval battles and not a lot of deaths. We are told there are a lot of Ottoman deaths on this bridge. I mean, they're not as well armored as the knights, and they're certainly not as well skilled as the knights. And now the knights, doesn't matter, their numbers are few, because they don't need many, and they can rotate in and out, and that appears to be what they do. I mean, this is a pretty amazing, there's nothing like it. Have you ever heard of anything like this? I mean, we talk about Xerxes crossing the Bosphorus on pontoon bridges. We talk about Alexander building the whole mole out to Tyre. I mean, what the heck? A pre-made bridge.
Oh, it's amazing.
And they fight.
Yeah. Well, Dobasson tells us that it goes from the middle of the night. They do this in the middle of the night. Obviously, you do this under cover of dark. to have the best chance of getting the beachhead, right? Getting people across. They just don't manage it.
Yeah.
The hospital is able to catch him on this. It says it goes until from the middle of the night until the hour of 10 that they're fighting on this.
Yeah.
Before the bridge is broken.
Yeah.
And the floating bridge, Dobasan says, the floating bridge is broken by our gunfire. And then the Turks all went into the water.
I've always envisioned this, the last moment when the bridge, you know, wouldn't you like to, you're on the ottoman on the middle of the bridge and it starts swaying back and forth. What are you going
to
do?
Oh my God. It's hard to imagine what this must have been like. I mean, you know, they all go into the water. And yeah, I mean, what was, how many shots did it take before that happened? Right. You know, the, imagine the shots sort of hitting the water, like splashing as the hospitals are trying to hone in, trying to get the right range. And finally one hits and boom.
There is a gun, a large cannon in Paris now that says that it actually has an inscription on it that says it was in Tower St. Nicholas. It dates to after this. So we don't know, especially as the illuminations show no gunpowder weapons on the tower. These are probably fired from the walls of the city. And that would have been a heck of a shot. Remember, nobody's aiming these things specifically.
Spray and pray, as the kids say.
Both sides are praying.
Just different ones. So they managed to actually stop this. And it's Dobasan says that deserters, they actually, some Ottomans desert.
I wonder why.
And they say that 2,500 Ottomans die in this assault alone, in that assault alone. Now, over the course of the entire siege, it's many, many thousands of Ottomans die. It's extraordinary number versus, I mean, very, very few knights or soldiers, anybody in the city, very few casualties in the city.
And the interesting thing is, you know, we do talk about exaggerations of numbers and so forth. And once you get there and you realize, and then you see the illumination, you see the painting also has this bridge across, because it is such an amazing, original idea. The numbers are not exaggerated here. I think that when you're fighting from the middle of the night to 10 in the morning and the Ottomans are just completely pouring across this bridge, we're not yet talking about retreats or pauses in there or anything. But I don't doubt that there was 2,500 killed. I'd be surprised if it was that few there.
I mean, it's just, it is, I hate to keep saying it. Like, look at a map. Look at a map on this, people. Yeah. And imagine this bridge being just like I said, like a gate, just rolling around across. You can see the now the mole. St. Nicholas Tower is still there. It's marked, and there's kind of a sort of an L shape on the end of that, sort of a beak on the end of that. That wasn't there.
That comes wasn't up there. After.
So it would be actually that whole opening from St. Nicholas Tower across to the shore. That's where this thing came across. It's just amazing.
And you got to think, if you're an Ottoman and you're wounded, you go in the water, you're dead. I mean, there's no, you know, swimming over to the other side and getting, I mean, I'm sure there were some, but you can't retreat back against the army that's continuing to come from the Ottoman side. So you go in the water, chances are, and if you've got any type of a wound, you're going to not make it back alive.
Just awful. Just awful.
Yeah.
But
the interesting, it's over, done. Hospitallers defeated, you know, from early, I mean, over that space, maybe, you know, who knows, 15 hours, 16 hours that they're fighting. And then it says it absolutely gets quiet. Carson says it just, everything goes quiet. And the Ottomans move their entire siege army to the northeast side, all the way around the entire side of roads
and
to the north.
And another thing that's interesting is this when this bridge happens, this is the 20th of June. So this is actually very early that they do this, which implies, I think, that they kind of had this plan for. This wasn't something they kind of did on the fly.
No, this has got to be.
They had this figured out. They had had enough intel about what they were going to face. Like, they have got a plan. So both sides here, the Hospitallers know that something's coming. They've got a plan to be ready for it. And the Invaders, they've got a plan too. We've got something that is gonna make this happen for us. And here it's failed. And so, as Kelly says, they move their entire siege to another part of the walls.
It fails, so we probably don't know the originator. Maybe if it had been successful, somebody
would have claimed the idea.
Nobody on the Ottoman side is saying this was their idea now that it's failed. But yeah, talk about time. So the 10th of June, they do not attack again until the 27th of July. But they're there. Hospitallers can see them. They can see them making the move. And they move all the way around the city. Now, we can walk around the city. What do you think it took us to walk around the city? Of course, we kept stopping and
observing
things. You'd probably walk around that outside of the city in a half.
Yeah, I would think easy. Yeah, if you weren't stopping to.
But you're moving bombards. You're moving everything. I mean, the illuminations and the painting all show these things being moved and actually placed over on the northeast side. There's a mole that's now underwater that had. That had gallows on it, so that you know, anybody who was executed is executed out on that mole, and that appears to have been one of the sightings for the new guns, as well as the just over the moat at the very end. So they're right at the end of the moat and the beginning of the beginning of the sea where they put up their guns. It's called the Jewish Quarter by Dobuson and Cowerson, because this is apparently is where the Jewish community was. They have been moved out to fortify that wall, Dobuson says. Unfortunately, and this is kind of letting stuff out later, is Dobuson will become cardinal, and as soon as he becomes cardinal, he kicks all the Jews out. And we're told that they actually are helping during this siege. So it's an unfortunate bigotry that exists within the Christian forces that eventually they'll move exile all the Jews from the city of Rhodes in the end of the 16th century, end of the 15th century.
A bigotry that's all too common, unfortunately, in this period.
Yeah, all too common, yeah. But especially so here, because we are told that the Jewish people are helping as much as anybody else.
Yeah. On the 27th of July, Jewish quarter is attacked.
It is attacked. And it is not a small attack. This isn't a we're going to wait until the bridge gets in place or anything. We are told the whole thing erupts. Yeah. Everything on that side erupts. And miners go into the moat, start filling the moat with rocks so they can move across it easily. The knights are shifting. I mean, they've been watching all the walls. They know this is happening. This isn't a surprise. I think the force at this point, Misha Pasha knows that he's got to do something. And so let's just hit him with full force. And now we're told into the moat and against the wall go the soldiers. The Ottoman soldiers too. They've been pretty inactive up to this point.
Yeah, the Janissaries especially, we know, go in at this point by the thousands.
Yeah. And we're told, and they're, they're trying to take by force a large medieval fortification at this point. And that is not easily done, as everybody who studies, we talked about it, Orléans, of course, they just stood out and waited for the siege to happen. Fortresses weren't attacked, and especially not without siege machines, and that's what's happening now. Of course, they are bombarding the walls. They're making some rends in the walls, they're making some holes in the walls and stuff like this. The knights are over there, but they're firing down at these people that are coming across. So there's got to be a huge bloodshed.
Who are firing up? And Dobuson. Up on those walls, right in the thick of it.
Directing things.
What happens to him?
Well, we're told that so it takes a little bit of time. You know, I mean, the siege is not actually over until the 17th of August. So they've got about a week, 2 weeks. And then they've got the moat pretty well filled. We've got the moat that's pretty well filled. And so now the Ottomans are actually coming across and able to put ladders up against the walls and come up on top of the wall. And we're told they actually take the walls of the Jewish quarter for a while. And then the final attack comes and everybody heads across. The same knights are still there. And Dobuzon's in the middle of them. And he tells us, it's amazing to hear the words of him, because then you get the story from Cowerson, who kind of reveals that Dobuzon's a bit humble in this. Dobuzon says, I was knocked off the walls and wounded three times in the battle, in this final thing. And Cowerson says that he is fighting like a lion up there. All the hospitals are fighting like a lion. Cowerson is not a soldier. He's right. So he's looking down from the ground up there. And they're hand-to-hand combat. And a part of the wall would be taken by the Ottomans. They put their banners up, and the hospitals would rush in and take the banners down, put theirs back up. It went on and on, this last conflict. The death rate on both sides must have been something. Well, just give you an example of what Dobuzon went through on that day. He will be buried in the robes and armor he was wearing that day. So when he finally dies, and that's not until the 1503, when he finally dies, they bury him in the robes with all his blood and everybody else's blood on him in the Church of St. John on the other. And we know this, not the St. Church of St. John was blown up by accident in the 18th century, 19th century. But we know this because in the middle of the 1522 siege, they take his body out and run it around the walls, and everybody says, oh, by the way, it's still filled with blood.
All this stuff on him. And his account, as you say, he's fairly humble about this. In what he's saying, he says, we received wounds, you know, kind of thing. And Cowerson's like, Cowerson says five times the guy's wounded.
Five times he got wounded. Three times he gets knocked off the wall onto the ground. And he gets back up and roll. You know, there's, of course, we write about bravery a number of times. Where I see in our reader, we've got several accounts. Pierre Nino, who's almost in Spain, who's almost superhuman.
Yeah, psychotic.
Dobuzon, and we're not talking a young guy either. I mean, he's not a spring chicken, this man. And he keeps going up on the wall and fighting. Cowerson, I mean, at that point, I think Cowerson has been his faithful all the way through and recording this siege. Cowerson goes overboard in trying to praise the knights on that day, and especially Cowerson. I mean, he talks about the ferocity leonis, the ferocity of lions.
Yeah, I mean, he's Dobuzon's 57 at this point.
57.
Yeah. He's up there.
So
smashing away. And the numbers that are given on these assaults, the initial assault on the Jewish quarter and then the subsequent days, you get the impression that, they were trying to fill that moat and those trenches with rocks, but they're also just being filled with bodies. There's thousands that are falling.
Yeah.
And in these fights on the wall, Dobuzon will tell us, 3,500 Turks died that day. He uses the word Turks for the enemy.
The first day of assault, 3,500.
And then it was 4,000 the assault before that, and 2,500 the assault. These numbers, I mean, even if they're a little bit exaggerated, which you look at the fortifications and stuff, I'm not sure they are.
No.
I mean, it's just an astounding number. And again, not that many hospitalers are going down, but any that do go down, you're that much weaker. And this has been going on for many weeks. So Dobuzon
and Cowerson does talk about the hospitalers being wounded.
Yeah, he talks about the hospital, I think.
Yeah. I mean, they get taken to the hospital. Now that's why they need the two hospitals that are still there.
Yeah.
They've got to have been filled. But it appears, like Dobuzon, that anybody who was wounded and still upright stayed. and they fought. I mean, they knew if they lost this quarter, there was nothing to keep the Ottomans of overrunning the town very easily. There were the interior fortifications. The knights could have gotten behind them, but the town itself would have fallen really rapidly, and the people would have been killed. And so so would have the any wounded or hospitals. It wouldn't have taken long to get into the hospital quarters as either.
No, this was the stand. I mean this line.
Yeah. This is do or die. There's no question. Do or die. And they also know that, you know, there's if they get captured, they're dying. It is really do or die.
Why do you think the Pasha ultimately says we're done?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So on the 17th of August, the knights come, you know, the day opens and there's nobody over there. I mean, the siege camp is still there, but it's clear the troops are leaving. And I think it's Carrison who's a little bit iffy in his account. I mean, he's writing this after the siege has been defeated. But he still talks about the fact that they didn't expect. They figured probably they would move to another section and come in. No, Pasha takes them home. And I've thought about that. I mean, I've sat because I've walked roads over and over again with you and with Katie Smith and Ruth Brown. And, you know, we've talked about this. Why would he leave? I mean, one of the things is the Sultan's not there. I mean, we're going to revisit this in 1522. And the numbers that are lost here are minuscule compared to what is lost in 1522. But then the Sultan's there. Suleiman the Magnificent is there in 1522. Mehmed is on his deathbed. And the insecurity of an Ottoman succession, especially with Mehmed having two sons, two prominent sons who could take over. I'm not entirely certain the Pasha or Misha Pasha estimated that he would find a live Sultan when he went back to Istanbul. It also has got to be, you know, I mean, the Sultan can order all these people to death, but if they still persisted and couldn't get this town, which it looks like after these two assaults, they can't. I think they go home and try to say, we'll be back another day.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Pasha, we don't hear that he is executed or anything. He doesn't really appear in history once again. So we don't know what happens, but it was an ignominious defeat. And he goes and that's that. We're done.
Well, Pasha, we know he lives until 1501.
So he does. So nothing happens.
He does all right. So what, you know, what do you think, what's the thing that you wish you knew, the piece of information or something that you wish you had about this? And our last call as the bar is trying to close on us here.
Yeah. And, you know, we're fortunate because we actually have these eyewitnesses. So we don't need to say, oh, I wish what Pierre d'Aubusson's thinking. I wish that we do not have an account from the Ottomans. There's not even a siege diary kept during this one. At least it's never been found. So we have no clue what they're thinking. We have no idea. We're only seeing it through the eyes of the hospitalers, and they're fighting the great armies of Satan in their view. And by the way, God had,
of course,
you know, spoiler alert, God's on their side.
Of course.
No, but it would be interesting. God is Allah has abandoned the Ottomans. I'm sure they wouldn't have written that down, but I wish they'd had something written down. They probably did. And I'd like to see what.
And I 100% agree with you. This is, we find this on many occasions where we only have one side of some kind of important event, and we know that side is biased. We know that side is problematic, and we don't have the other side. You know what were they thinking in their count? How many were lost in their count? Like, what were they thinking? How long was that bridge planned? Who planned it? There's so much unknown about what was going on. All that we have is the, you know, sort of the event horizon of what the hospitalers can see from the walls. That's the extent of our knowledge of this amazing event. anything beyond that event horizon, it's gone to us. Unless it somebody can find in some place some unedited, undiscovered manuscript, it's all we're ever going to have. And that's enormously frustrating.
And it's a little different. I mean, we do have this one one account from a knight. I mean, it's argued that he was there. I think he was. Mary Dupuis, and he gives us a soldier's account, which is always nice to have. We've got that for 1522 too. And that's nice to see it from kind of the ground up, in this case, another hospitaller from the ground up. But, no Ottoman. And that would be really nice to have. This is an amazing victory. You go to the city, as Mike said, and everybody should. That's your homework assignment. Go to Rhodes to see this. And then you take into the two sieges in account. It's hard not to actually marvel that this is a spot where thousands died, and it's a piece of rock. It's a piece of rock in the middle of the Eastern Mediterranean.
And it has good food. I mean, I just gotta say that.
Yeah. Even Mike even ate a little fish.
I did. Yeah. People know me. I'm not a big seafood guy, but I was like, if I'm ever going to do some seafood here, this is straight out of the Mediterranean. I'm doing it. And,
that day, I mean, you can find it. It's probably still wiggling.
That didn't help. But it's Rhodes is an incredible place. It's gorgeous. And it is, it's a military laboratory, at least for this period, from medieval into the early modern, to be able to see the work that they're doing, which we will hear more about when we talk about 1542.
Yeah, anti-gunpowder weapon, devices, everything is there between 1480 and 1522. D'Aubusson will himself build a huge bastion in the next couple of years. He will order this huge bastion built. So he recognizes that there's some weaknesses and that without the tenacity, and that's one of the things, let's put it down to it. And it's maybe even the final verdict on Rhodes, the Knights Hospitaller led by D'Aubusson. I mean, everybody wants technological determinism, all this other stuff. This was determined by men and their leader.
Men who fought like a lion.
Men who fought like a lot. Ferocity
of a lion. So there you go, folks. The bar is closed. But we are very hopeful that you will tell us what your questions are and so that we can have some great stuff to talk about on our next episode, our Q&A episode of Bow and Blade, when we'll be answering those questions that you send in. Don't make us make up our own questions. You send them in, people. So visit patreon.com/medievalists and leave a comment there. Tell us what you want to know. And that way you also support our sponsor, medievalists.net. So cheers to that. Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody have a great time. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.